get these dates in order. I have them out of order here a little bit.
Okay. Well, let's correct that then.
Well, the correct order is at the university in 1972. I was invited by Joe Fletcher, who was head of Office of Polar Programs, to come back and serve as a program manager for meteorology and oceanography and for the polar regions. That's both Antarctica and the Arctic.
And that's at National Science Foundation.
National Science Foundation. And this would be a temporary job, and it was called an IPA, Intergovernmental Personnel Act. And so I would be on loan for 2 years. That's where the tenure thing rang a bell, because here on tenure, this is not, if you're going up, that is not a big brownie point.
To go be a program manager.
Now, you see a lot of our faculty who do that sort of thing, don't come back.
Yeah.
They usually go one way. They go out the door and it gets a little bit...
So why doesn't it count for tenure?
Well, if you look at the academic, our service is education, right? Mm-hmm. Teaching, research, and public service, not administration.
Oh, that doesn't count as public service.
It counts as administration.
Oh, okay.
And that doesn't count at all, really, when you come up, when you're being judged on your professional.
But once you become tenured, I mean, there's plenty of faculty who move into administration.
That's right.
But it's after they've gotten tenured.
Who cares after
okay.
that? Nobody okay. judges them on that. They can do whatever they want. So they, nevertheless, I thought this was a very good entree for me, because I have to go find money like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And we know what the realities of life are, believe me. So I went back. And I loved it. I felt that if I had stayed there any longer, I probably never would have come back. I would have been in Antarctica, because that was where I had my first foot in the Antarctic continent. But I was very fortunate going back, because another professor from Old Dominion University came to Alaska, and he was working in my laboratory on his sabbatical, and he liked what we were doing, and we had money. And so I was able to convince the Office of Naval Research and my NSF colleagues who are funding that this is okay. He'll take over. I come back to Washington. Then I go back to Alaska, and everything's fine. That's not the way it worked. At the end of my 2 years there, I got the person I worked for at the National Science Foundation, Joe Fletcher, was named associate director of the OCSEP program
okay.
in Boulder. He asked me if I would join him, and just for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, he and I were writing a chapter in a book on polar climate. And I thought, boy, this is just great if I can... You know, if I can do this. And so the university agreed. Don Hood was very skeptical that, you know, that this is the greatest thing that I should be doing for my career. But on the other hand, there was no objection. And I went out and worked with Fletcher. It took more like 9 months to get this, because there's a lot of money that had to go north.
Mm-hmm.
I sat on the committee that was voting on who gets that money. So it was Norton. So we had two Alaskans, three of them, an agricultural fellow. While I was there, Max Britton called me and asked, he said, we're going to need a director for the Arctic Research Lab, NARL. Would you apply? I said, I would apply as long as I can keep my faculty job and do this. He worked it out with Bill Wood. Bill and I got along very well, and they agreed that I could do this. And I thought, this is going to be tough sledding coming back, because, you know, this is another administrative job, and so I'm going to have to keep the research going and publish and so forth. I didn't know whether I could do that. But I was willing to try it. And I agreed. And so that's why the last part of that tape, and I was getting mixed up on the dates. The dates now mesh quite correctly, right, because by 1976, I had finished at NOAA, and we published the book and with our chapter in Polar Climate, and I was on my way to Barrow. So my next step was showing up at Barrow in 1976.
Can you remember what OCSEP stands for?
Outer Continental Shelf Environmental Assessment Program.
Okay, thank you. I knew it.
It actually was longer than that. It was the BLM / NOAA. There was always fighting between those two agencies. And so eventually NOAA wanted to insist it become the NOAA BLM study. I don't know how it ever really ended.
Well, anyway, so your time with OCSEP, you said you were science liaison officer?
Yes, for the state of Alaska.
For the state of Alaska.
Yeah, with Hammond administration.
Okay. And so you sort of facilitated the research projects and the money and managed all of it?
We sat on the planning committee for planning. We did the workshops to look at the assessment. Where should the money go? Where should the emphasis go? And essentially everybody who had a foot in the door wanted their piece of the action.
Right.
Now that's the short answer. Mm-hmm. There's probably a long political answer, but that's the short one.
Right. And now, during this time, you were not physically here in Fairbanks, so you couldn't be teaching courses.
No. Teaching was zero for that. And the only way I could make up for that in the smallest way was to get interested in the education, science, math, and engineering, Native students. And that's where it started, and that's in earnest, mm-hmm. and grew, and then brought back to Fairbanks. And when I finally did come back, I was able to find funding from ONR, from NSF, from DOE. I think there may have been NOAA in there somewhere, and having our students here through ACES, using ACES, the American Indian Science and Engineering Society.
Okay.
And by working with those folks and Sue McHenry, we got a lot of students through our system, giving them an opportunity to not only work in ocean sciences, but a wide variety of the sciences that we could introduce them to. Mm-hmm. And many of them today have gone on for advanced degrees, PhD, and I still see them around town.
So that program, it helped provide funding for the students to take these classes?
Provide funding and training. So we would, we're a marine group, so we would, in those days we did have access to the ship. Mm-hmm. So it was not unlikely that we would have them out on the Alpha Helix for several days, or down at Kositsna Bay or Seward, or one of our marine stations, doing marine-related subjects, but nevertheless multidisciplinary.
Okay, so they got coursework and hands-on training.
Right.
And perhaps a more one-on-one support and encouragement from people like you.
That's right. And I'm very grateful for our faculty. Many of our faculty were very supportive, especially Dr. Naidu. And he and I really did a lot to spearhead this program, and we still do as much as we can.
Yeah. And now, did the program have a particular name? It was ACES, or
yes,
was something else?
Well, we what did we call it? It had several names. Just give me a moment to think.
Because now I hear about ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science
and Engineering program. Okay. Yes, that's a big one. Mm-hmm. An NSF out of Anchorage. And we were never able to really link officially with ANSEP, but we called our program Orion, O-R-I-O-N.
Okay.
The Orion program.
And it was just for students in marine sciences?
None of our students had to be specifically oriented to the marine sciences. If they came in and wanted to do a social sciences program, I can't give you any indication that they did, that we would accept them and make arrangements for them to do that. But most most of them came in for basically the science training, to be exposed to it. We have at least one who is a medical student, WAMI program, and she was one of our better students. You know.
And so where did the students come from?
Well, they were all students here at UAF, and and they came from all over Alaska.
From the villages?
From the villages, yeah.
Well, it sounds like a great program, and it's continuing?
No. Unfortunately, I'm retired, and we don't have the funding to support it. So, unfortunately, it has gone. But the ANSEP program has picked up, and that's a well-funded program, and should be doing well. I think if we and if Naidu and I were younger, and still active, we would have some interest in doing that. And Sati may still have that, but I think we're sort of leaning more toward Ollie.
for
ourselves.
When the Orion program was in full swing, we're talking like the, when did you start it? In the 80s?
Yes.
It was in the 1980s?
Well, we really started at Barrow.
Right.
With the students, because the students there had a communications program at the high school, a good one. And they were doing television, and they had VHS television, making tapes. And we did one on with them. I can remember that for public broadcast in the Barrow area on the Aurora. And they did that filming at the Gnarl. We also did other lectures, quite a few of them. I remember one of them where we took one of our graduate students. Who was very interested in robotics, and this would be back in the 80s when there was really not much exposure here to robotics, not like you see today. This is quite different now, the 2000s, and we took him to Barrow with us, and he went up there. He taught every class, including the homeschool children. And he had them. They have a swimming pool, which they use for their water for fire prevention. And there, he was able to put his robot in the water, television, and the students were able to put devices in the water, pick up the devices, and to take them various places. So it was a tremendous. His name was John Tershak. He went from there to University of California. Sacramento, or Davis, then I think I lost track of him.
Right. Well, I think that's great that you started this interest in the Native students in Barrow, and then you carried it on into a broader group here out of UAF.
Yes, I just sent a message back to College of Rural Development. I received an award from them. It's now called the Dennis Demmert Prize, but in those days, I don't remember its name. They're having a celebration here, just about the time I'm going to be in Seattle, so I won't be able to go to it. They were wanting to get something from all the awardees over the past years, and they give one a year.
And what was the award for?
My interaction with Alaska Native students in science, math, and engineering.
Okay. Yeah, I remember from talking to you before that you were very active in helping Native students transition into UAF and with math and science.
No, it has been very uplifting for me, hopefully useful for them.
Do you have any sense how many students went through that Orion program?
No, I don't.
Okay. Or how many did you have maybe at one
time? We would have no more than 10 at one time.
Okay. And so how many years did it operate?
We started just as soon as I came back from Barrow, 1980. Mm-hmm. That's when it started. And I had money for at that time, probably by 81, for the National Science Foundation. And I was also able to get some funding from Office of Naval Research to help with that program as well.
Mm-hmm. And then it lasted until your retirement?
Yeah, pretty much so. And there it was, Department of Energy.
Uh-huh.
And that ceased about 2000. Well, I retired in 2010 or 11. And that ceased about 2000, well, about 2010.
Okay. That's a long time.
Yes. But it's worth it.
That's great. And so 76 to 80, you were back living in Barrow, being the NARL director?
76 to 80, I was in Barrow as the director, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you helped transition it to closure then?
My job was to do exactly that. At the same time, we were trying to find a new host. And the political situation is such that any new host is going to ask the question, where am I going to find the money to run this lab, plus the fact that the community itself had different ideas about how that land should be used. Some of the land was ideally set up for building houses and roads. It was a beach ridge, so it's relatively dry. It's a wet tundra environment, but it's drier than elsewhere. And so there was competition. One of the goals that the scientific community wanted to see was to preserve the old sites where work had been done over so many years, from its establishment back in the 1940s.
46, 47, yeah.
47. And Jerry Brown played a big part in that because he was director of the International Tundra Biome. And the area out about where the dew line is, mm-hmm. that general area in there, the idea was to set that aside as a bioreserve, the Barrow Environmental Observatory, BEO. In fact, in my office, I still have a stake labeled BEO that we put out there.
And so it was important to science to have the same kind of plots and locations, yes, so they could do comparative studies?
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And now, the land, through the Land Claims Act, got transferred several different times through North Slope Borough, and then UIC. UIC is the landowner.
The Village Corporation.
So UIC has the, can pretty much say, hey, we don't want the BEO out here. On housing development, there are competing interests. You know, there's the NOAA Clean Air Site.
Mm-hmm.
Housing development wouldn't exactly be desirable. The BEO doesn't hurt anybody. You know, people go in there very careful about even stepping on the tundra.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to manage it? Who's going to pay for it? Who's going to pay for people coming up who want to do studies out there? Are they going to charge them? And the answer is yes. Some ways. I know that Department of Wildlife Management operated the old animal research,
right,
facility, which Max liked to call it vivarium. recalled it the Animal Research Laboratory, ARF, or Animal Research Facility.
Right.
And when Tom Albert was there, Tom came up as a visiting scientist to the lab, I think for 1 year, never left. When we closed, he quit University of Maryland and went down to the town, became the science advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And then they established the Science Advisory Committee, and I became the chair of that. And then just recently, within a year, that all disappeared. There's no need for that anymore. Okay. They have their own staff.
Right. So what was it like being the director of NARL for those 4 years?
Oh, it was really excellent. It was wonderful. We had a lot of things going on. I had to keep my hand in the science, which I wanted to do. Otherwise, I would be doomed.
Yeah, what sort of research were you continuing to do?
The CO2 in the ocean, trace metals, and with NIDU. Basically, that was it. I had a holdover from my Antarctic program that I had funded on radioactivity. In other words, using Sentinel 25 generators to run a meteorological program remotely. And we tried to bring that. We essentially were kicked out of Antarctica because of world community dislike of anything radioactive on the continent. And in order to bring that to Barrow, it was just not worth it. Hostility toward it was too great. And we recognized better use traditional power methods instead of radionuclides.
It's interesting how the sentiments of the times affect research.
Yes. Well, they were really affected this one. Mm-hmm. So but we knew better. And that work, there still isn't anything up there. There's no Sentinel, no RTGs. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason why there shouldn't be, in my estimation. But on the other hand, there are plenty of critics out there to counter that feeling.
Well, speaking about, societal interests and research, I'm kind of going to shift this into the whole climate change debate and your work with CO2. I'm assuming you've become quite involved in the whole questions of climate change, and can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, they're certainly very complicated, and I can certainly sympathize and understand the worry that the general public has about climate change, or whether we believe the scientist or not believe the scientist, I think is irrelevant. It's part of human nature. If you look at just the physics and chemistry of gases in the atmosphere, a gas such as CO2 is very well known and has been for a very long time to be able to assist in the change of an atmospheric by warming if it increases. And we can show without a doubt that CO2 in the atmosphere has been increasing as long as we've been measuring it, and estimated to be increasing ever since the Industrial Revolution. The big question is it the only culprit? If you talk to some of the scientific community, for example, they'll say, we're due for cooling. And on the other hand, that's not what we see. We see a steady warming, at least over the last 75 to 100 years of measurement. If you try to demonstrate this to students in a laboratory setting, it's very easy to demonstrate it. And so perhaps the question then comes, is CO2 and other radiatively important gases, such as methane and so forth, all increasing? Are they the main culprit, the only culprit, or partial culprit? But whatever it is, there's a culprit in there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it takes a life of its own. What do you do about it? Shutting down the coal plants and everything else is probably would slow things down, wouldn't stop them right away. There's a lot of momentum. But on the other hand, when people's livelihood are at stake, and you don't have what do we do now? It just seems like there's going to be a big political problem mm-hmm. to contend with. Which is what we say.
Mm-hmm. So you say with your research, you're saying this. The science shows that there's an increase in CO2.
That's right.
There's a change.
We see it in mid-latitudes, we see it in Antarctica, and we see it here.
So then the question is it science or it's politics, and how those two relate to each other?
Science and politics, yes.
And so as a scientist, do you see yourself having a role?
Well, I think my role has been as the technical person. That is the gatherer of information. I don't see myself as the politician. Now, maybe that's how I'll end up. But
well, have you played a role in using the data you've collected to advocate or to give it to politicians to let them make decisions?
Yes, we have done that. We have done it through our conferences. There was president of AAAS, Arctic Division, some years ago. We did a little symposium in Anchorage, and we all make our contributions through writing. That here are things that you need to look at. Have I proselytized for what should be done? That it should be cease and desist on all fossil fuel burning and go 100% solar? No, I haven't done that, because that transcends a lot of other things, economics and politics. But I do think that we should be talking about it in great earnest, because we're not going to get away with this if we don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know there are these big international policy councils and committees and all that thing made up of scientists, and I didn't know if you've been involved with any of those.
None other than contributing data, through papers. I have not been actively on any of those committees. They're necessary. They're not without criticism, and I've had bad feelings come up in some cases, but they are necessary.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause, yeah, I was just thinking that you've been involved with CO2 research since before anybody else even knew what CO2 was, and now it's the big new hot topic, and so how you've been involved in all that.
Well, it is, but even the people at Scripps and Keeling himself stayed out of the spotlight mm-hmm. with respect to that problem.
The debate,
yes.
Yeah.
And I personally believe, speaking only for myself on this, that this is the wise thing to do, to preserve our own credibility as technical people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that answered my question.
Yeah.
how you see yourself as a scientist in your role.
No, I see myself as a scientist, not a politician.
And not an advocate.
No, I can never keep my private thoughts. Of course, I would have ideas if I were to see the czar of the world.
Right.
You know, how I would handle the world. But that's not my business to do that, and I only degrade my own credibility if I do it.
Okay. I want to talk a little bit about teaching, because we haven't talked about that. Once you came back in 1980, did you sort of get into teaching and having graduate students and things like that?
I got into it right away. The usual vigor. The first course I taught when I came back was Applied Oceanography, or Shipboard Techniques, it was called. And we were blessed in those days with having the state give us about a 10 days of ship time. Eventually that dwindled down to zero, because the state, it was fund one money.
Oh.
And that gets scooped when things get tight. that gets scooped up awfully fast.
So then you had to rely on grant money.
Grant money, that's right. And that's hard to come by because as the shipboard money decreased, the ship operating costs were taking almost an exponential rise. Mm-hmm. So it not only made it less attractive to find the money, it made it almost impossible to get enough to get the days you would really like to have. Mm-hmm. So you had to be clever and do different things. Use smaller boats for various things. Use places that would be subsidized, like Kositna Bay. And even Seward, there were potential to go there without getting asking your account number. Mm-hmm. At any rate, that was the nature of our lives for all those years. And you asked originally about retirement. That's one of the joys of not having to do that.
Look for money.
You're out there like the beggar on the... Not much different than the beggar on the street.
Yeah, well, say, you know, you want to be out doing research and how much time it takes to be writing the grants versus how much time you're actually
It takes an enormous amount of time. And a lot of them don't get funded. Mm-hmm. An enormous amount of time goes into that. Mm-hmm. Especially today with the multi-participant.
Mm-hmm. So what was your favorite part? Research, teaching, being at the university at all? I don't know.
I like all of them. I get along well. I enjoy the research life very much. I wouldn't want the research life to be, no matter what I did, absolutely dominant or over everything. So it took up. There was no time for the teaching, and I never believed that the teaching should be a shoddy job. Those students deserve to get the best they can get because they're paying for it, mm-hmm. and I remind them of that even today with my. With my course that I have, I see students slacking up a little bit. I go, look, you're paying $800-$900 for this course. I said, it hurts me when I see you not take advantage of getting your lessons in and so forth. So I'm very conscious of that. Mm-hmm. The public service, as you know, is a small fraction of what we have here, but it is important that we communicate science to the community, and I don't look at that as a chore. I look at that as a desirable thing to do. That's what I want to do. But we can't, of course, spend all of our time on PR. Or that would not be our business. We should be in some other business.
So do you have some examples of things you did in terms of service and communicating science?
Well, we ran several newsletters over our time. I come a bit before the blogging age, mm-hmm. so to speak, if it were 20 years in the future, I'd probably be doing an awful lot of that and web pages and so on. We'd have those web pages. That was a bit before my time. I'm still VHS, you know, and slides and overheads.
Right, and newsletters.
And newsletters.
Printed newsletters.
Lots of talks, and I do like that. So I'd be giving lots of lectures, both public lectures and workshops. And we've done field studies, especially in the north. You know, we bring the people to see what we're doing. We did run one thing I did like very much and enjoy when we could afford it. For quite a few years, we ran teacher training courses in the marine sciences. So we have the teachers come mainly to Seward or Kositna Bay and then give them actual projects, work with them in the field so that they can transfer that knowledge and kind of joy that you get out of going out and say, look, this is how a stream works. You can ask the students questions or the teachers questions. Look at this stream. You can hardly see through it. It has all of this material in it. Where do you think that's going? And if it's going into the ocean, it's been doing this for eons. What's happening? can we make some prediction? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes. You can go out there and you can measure it. You can take crude instruments and make measurements of the particulates in the water. And you can say, well, the water moves this fast for this many months. This is the amount of stuff that gets down into the ocean. It gets dumped under the bottom, and it starts building up. And so we can see that Seward isn't going to look like Seward does now, 1,000 years from now or 2,000 years from now, unless something else happens. And there are little examples like this that we can use. And that's what I consider to be kind of a joyful experience.
And so that was the teacher, school teachers were sort of becoming temporary field assistants.
Yes, but they're also learning how to do these things themselves and then transfer that back to their students.
Right.
In fact, just recently, one of our TAs, when I was teaching 111, which I taught for many years here, face-to-face, one of my TAs, Jennifer Bell, came to my office some months ago, and she talking about, well, they want to do 111 in Nome. And I said, great. And we had a set of books that would give them the various laboratory-type things they could do without buying much, because these schools don't have that kind of money to go out and purchase expensive scientific gear. You know, if you just buy a simple net, you're spending $1,000. But you can make a net. In fact, in some respects, it's even better because you get the students to use their head in common sense and not just say, well, I don't have $1,000 net, I can't do the work. The answer is you can do the work. We're just going to have to work a little bit harder in putting this thing together. It'll be clever. So that's what you want to do, teach the students to be clever. And so that's what we were up to. So we were able to transfer those to Jennifer. And I guess they didn't have enough students to make it pay for what they had to pay the teachers.
And that's through the e-learning program that you said you're very involved.
Well, no, this was for what they're doing out there. They're doing it through College of Rural Development, I believe it is.
It's the UAF campus.
It's the UAF campus. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, e-learning is, I'm not totally sure how that's operated, but I believe it's independent now. And is mainly just that. It's electronic learning.
And that's what you're now doing in your retirement.
Yes. And I started at the North Slope Borough on real-time 1980s-type technology. I moved from there working with ATN across over in the Butrovich building, what they were doing television. They were just doing the wire the place up.
What is it, ATN?
That was, I don't know what the acronym is. It was the statewide system of communications. It was the only one we had. If you wanted to do any kind of long distance television or audio conferencing, you had to go through them in the 80s and 90s. And I got to know them and respect them very much. And they helped me very much in being able to set up my seminars and courses through ATN. And so what I would do to do that is we had regular televisions that you would see in the classrooms. You don't see them around here anymore, but it's old technology. And I would say, well, I'm going to... I had an acoustics seminar, which I did. So that's another area of my studies was acoustics. And so I would hook up University of Washington, University of Alaska Anchorage, and University of Alaska Fairbanks. You would go to ATM to do that, and they would make arrangements to have that all connected and hooked up. It had its warts on it, but it worked. And you can see, in my mind, I can say, look, this can only get better, not worse. Don't give up. Mm-hmm. Let's keep going and learn how to make this thing work. And true enough, the technology got cheaper. The technology outside and big industry and so forth became available, and the university now is wired up for this sort of thing, where it's commonplace to go into our smart classrooms.
You know, the Murry Auditorium.
The Murry Auditorium.
Where you look and there's a classroom in Seward.
Exactly. And we have it over in O'Neill, too. And then along the way, I got into Skype in my acoustics courses. There's an example where not many people are going to take marine acoustics for this very specialized course. And so that I was able to open up my classes, so I got students by using Skype. I'm the worst person in the world to be using these technologies, because I get really mad when they don't work my way. But nevertheless, here was Skype, and even after I retired, they had asked me, they had students in Juneau or Anchorage who needed a course. And it was for their graduate work. They wanted the acoustical oceanography or another course that I taught on that. And I would do that by Skype. Mm. So it was no problem for me to come in and just go to my office and do it. There are probably other examples.
I was thinking with the ATN, there was a time when with our phone lines, we had a terrible delay.
Yes.
And so did ATN have that problem?
Yes.
So you were sort of video conference, but you still had a delay.
You still had a delay.
Yeah.
It was crude. Today people get mad when it is an instant gratification. You just go back 20 years and see what it was like, you know.
Right.
But right now you're living in the lap of luxury.
Right. But the fact that you were using it and you clearly saw the benefits of
absolutely
using telecommunications for course delivery.
Well, I decided that in retirement, that's what I would do. I didn't think it would be quite as robust as it is. And just before I retired, I did another course called Environmental Oceanography. And the idea here is a lot of our students who come through the system are not very mathematically inclined, yet they're going to go into fields that a certain amount of mathematics is useful to them or will be useful to them. And so what I wanted to do was to introduce them to the ocean sciences, to giving them the basics. If they don't have the basics, we try to require 111, but if they don't have it, I take them anyway.
And so what is 111?
Oh, it's the basic oceanography course for non-scientists. But so I get the scientists, I have the fisheries students.
But that's the course number is 111?
111.
Okay.
111X, it's a four-credit course.
Okay.
So the I forgot what I was saying. With the courses, the television worked out very, very well.
Yeah.
And it's increasing now. The environmental oceanography course that I set up, that would give the mathematical training. And so what I want to do is to build on that. The first course I taught three times. It went through curriculum council as a trial course.
Mm-hmm.
Then I stopped. I ran out of gas, so to speak. I didn't have the energy to go. And so I've been trying to convince some of my colleagues, why don't you take it and I'll work with you.
Right.
You do it. But they don't want to do it, and they don't want to do the e-learning either. I've introduced them to it and brought them over, and I certainly am not going to try to fool them and tell them, you know, this is easier, because they can do a face-to-face course,
right.
Go into that lecture room for 3 hours a week, and they're done. With an e-course, it's 24/7. So the students are right there in your face.
They're contacting you by email.
By email. Yeah. It goes on any hour of the day.
Wow.
In fact, I know that, you know, Sunday night, I can guarantee it. It comes in like a freight train.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes Sunday night I'm up till 1 and 2 in the morning.
Wow.
Keeping up, you can't let it back up. And I don't use a TA. I don't know what I would do with them.
Right.
because nobody sees each other.
Right.
All we do is, in the beginning, is if you want to put a picture in, we can't require it. We would ask you to put a picture in, so for your fellow classmates who are in electronic land.
Right.
And so you get anything in there. Picture of their baby, their dog,
right.
their boat, a picture of a fish, whatever they want to do.
Well, overall, your many years here at the university, how would you assess that in your reflecting back overall in your career? What has it meant to you to have been here at UAF?
Well, it's exactly what I wanted to do and chose. Again, I use the word serendipity. And that's, to me, that's what it was. I proceeded in several cases. In fact, it goes all the way back to my undergraduate training. I met a Turkish scientist, a student who was in earth sciences with me. He wanted to go and do seismology in Turkey. I thought, absolutely fascinating land. I would like to do this. So I applied to Arabian American Oil Company. And fortunately, I didn't get the job because I think that would have been the wrong thing. Serendipity would have led me down the wrong path and put me into something probably that would not have been satisfied my curiosity the way I wanted to do it. I wanted to do all these other things, all of them, and participate in that. So that one was fortunate. And then from there, you heard the rest of the story, how it evolves from there. Finally got my connection with Scripps all those years. And just recently, in fact, this last year, we got together again and went back and I have a joint paper in Nature, a prestigious journal, and on CO2 and the seasonal variation. And we combine the data of my work and the work of others into this paper. So that was very nice to see that happen. So it brings some closure to this work.
Well, it sounds like from listening to you that being at UAF opened doors for you and gave you opportunities that perhaps you might not have had elsewhere. Is that accurate?
That's an accurate statement. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, UAF was. I would have to say that would I recommend the way I did things to other students coming through? And I would have to say no, because it was full of risk in doing that and not achieving what I wanted. I wanted the academic life. I liked that. I thought that suited me. Now, have I tried industry and so forth? I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't comment on it, or shouldn't comment on something I don't have any experience with. I might have, really liked it and become another Warren Buffett or something like that. I don't know.
You did at some point. We didn't talk about it, but at some point you got tenure along the way here.
I got tenure, yes, and that was my recommendation number two. Don't do this at home. This is not the way to do this.
Because the way in which you went for tenure?
It patched together. I think academia, at least the way it's presently construed, would really not support that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the best. However, academia is changing now. We find that but 46% of this campus is adjunct professors. This is probably one of the good ones. There are plenty of schools that are probably the other direction. There are lots. Commercial colleges are going very well, like Phoenix.
Right.
There are other ideas out there. The MOOCs by Stanford and Harvard and MIT with free courses, industry wanting certification. They don't care if you have a degree. They want certifications. They have certified workers coming in. So all these things are going to be the wave of the future and how the students approach them. Will the brick and mortar colleges that we see now stand? I think they will, at least for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there other things that you did here at UAF that I haven't asked about? You know, service with Faculty Senate, or, you know, we talked about Orion, but other things?
Well, I've served on all the committees. I served on the Promotion and Tenure Committee and the committee to seek the commencement speaker. Those have all been very, very good. I've been on most of the committees, both in my own college and or school and and the university. They were. I enjoyed those. I was on the strategic planning committee. I co-chaired that with Dana Thomas, in under I think it was Pat O'Rourke.
Yeah,
so
that was
Pat.
In the '90s.
'90s. Yeah. And. And then again, I was involved in several accreditations several times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're always doing these. I got a Usability Award.
Oh, okay.
And
that was for teaching? Is that what Usability is for?
For service to science,
okay.
And teaching. Yeah, I'm just losing track of all these things now.
And I haven't asked you about those gnarly years because I don't want to take up the time today focusing so much on those 4 years you were director, because we already did
yes.
that in a separate interview when I talked to you however many years ago. So I know that was a very important part of your career.
Yes.
And so unless we want to spend another hour here talking about it.
It's up to you. We can spend a bit more time if you want. It's really up to you
to
achieve what you want to get out of this.
I have. It's up to you whether you that there's more about that you want to talk about.
Well, specifically, what would you be looking for?
Just what it meant to you and what role it played in your career development.
Well, you know, I think that NORL. It's a sort of a separate career if you look at it, and I say this because it was the NSF that really gave me a good taste for managing things, and from there I ended up at the NORL, and this was a very good opportunity to work in a way where you had two leaders running the same organization. There was a Navy commander who was at the laboratory, and the technical director, me, the scientific director. And if you remember when you interviewed Max Brewer, the summary alludes to Max's antipathy toward having anybody up there.
Yes.
Muddling in how he ran the operation, and the operation was run today. You wouldn't get away with it,
right?
Because of the auditing and
right.
how you spent the money and so forth, and where you and what you did. So you might say that would put science back and slow it up. In the interest of safety and a whole lot of other things, there's some sense to playing by the rules. Whatever they are. If you don't like the rules, you can get them changed, maybe, perhaps. But this is a reality.
Right.
And when I got there, there had already been problems with a previous commanding officer. Even to the point where some of the employees were causing a bit of a problem. But I knew the commanding officers, I've kept track of most of them. Some have passed away, and some have got lost, one or two of them. Mm-hmm. But we even resurrected one from Whidbey Island, and are now back in touch with him again and his wife. So this worked out well for me. I understood at that time what our roles were, what his role was. He's the property owner manager, just like the commander at Fort Wainwright. Right. He's the property manager. The Striker Brigade comes in. They are a guest of the property manager. When there, they have a budget. They have so much they could use of the base and so forth. They know that they have to pay attention to all the rules and regulations of what the property manager has charged with doing.
So you were able to get along with the Navy very, commander?
Very well. I liked every one of them. Yeah. And we would have, you know, our intimate social gatherings that we would do together. And that was the same with the contractor who ran the camp. We ostensibly hired the contractor, but that was a bit of a joke. Here's the University of Alaska, which is a pipsqueak compared to ITT. You got to be kidding.
They were the contractor.
They were our subcontractor. And I was the contractor, University of Alaska. Oh. At any rate, we did get along very well with them, and they took care of all the crisis-type things whenever the union wanted to go on strike because of wages and so forth. You know, they would take care of that. That's something that they were responsible for doing, deliver us a product. This is the product, and this is how much money we have, you know. So if we can't come to some agreement, then we just don't do certain things and fold our tents.
Well, as you say, you had to work well on a team and work well together.
We worked, yeah. It worked well on a team. Yeah. We didn't do the sort of hair-raising things that Max got involved with, right, unless we were really specifically tasked to do it. We did sort of bend the rules. We didn't really break them. A good example of that was T3.
The ice
islands. T3 was when I took over the lab, T3 had been abandoned, and it was up around Ellesmere Island. But then from satellite surveillance, we were notified. In fact, it was by, I believe, the University of Alaska, that they looked at the Landsat, and they saw that T3 had moved. And so now we all began to track it through NOAA satellites, and it was moving south, and we said, it's coming by again. It's going to make another circuit. And so when the commanding officer and I talked about it, we all agreed, we got to go out there. This is important. We don't do it, the Russians will do it. And so it got stuck in McClure Straits. And I think in one of your interviews with Max, he talks about when he went out with the icebreaker to the McClure Straits. Well, it did get stuck there. An example of that, I was going to Sweden with my wife, and we were flying on an SAS jet from Anchorage. That's from the days when we used to have the International Air Corps. They still call it international here, yeah, you know, and we could go across the pole. Well, as we flew up over Kotzebue and then up toward Canada, in the McClure Straits, I sent a note to the pilot stating that T3 is at this latitude, longitude. And if you can see it, you might want to tell the passengers. He sent the stewardess or the flight attendant back and invited me up to the into the cabin. And he said, why don't you come up here? They were serving dinner, so she served my dinner up there on the flight deck. And I could look out, and I said, you look below, there it is. And so the pilot banked the plane so the passengers could see T3.
Neat.
And so when I got back to Barrow, I talked to the commander. I said, you know, the minute that moves, we need to have a plan, but we need to have the admiral sign off. And the admiral at that time was a very congenial guy. We liked him. He said, I can't tell you to back off. Occupy that island. He said, our orders here are not to get involved in running ice islands anymore. He said, but if there's an emergency of any type, you certainly would want to land on a safe piece of ice. That was our entree to do it. And so what we did is we figured if it's moving, we'll go ahead and there'll be some kind of emergency. And we were already supporting programs in northern Greenland, so we had to go right past it. And we sent the ski-equipped DC-3 over. And when it did move, moving down, we landed. And there they found a tractor. So they started to excavate the tractor and get it going, and it worked. First time they got it out. So here we are, T3 is viable. And then the next part was there was a buoy on T3 run for the Navy, and it was a classified experiment, not experiment, but knowledge, and T3 is heading toward Russia. So the Navy came up and said, well, if there's some need to be there to land, you might want to put the new battery into that buoy. So as T3 came around, it was getting very close. It was only 200 miles north of Barrow. Ahead of it was a Russian ice station by about 200 miles. It was manned. And so as the Russian station came through, we had our scientific group who wanted to go out. And so my orders to them, with concurrence of the commander, was, well, you know, if you have an emergency, for some reason you have to land, then do so, but keep us informed. Come right back. Well, everybody that day was putting things on the airplane. The women were, we have families, you know, up there. They were baking cookies and bread and things. I was just holding my head wondering, you know, this is, we're going to pay for this if this goes bad. And at any rate,
we are out of tape for a moment.